Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of CCYSC Awaaz. I'm Vidya Subramanian. I'm an assistant professor at the Center for Education, Innovation and Action Research, Tata Institute of Social Sciences, Bombay. I have with me today Dr. R. Maitreyi, who is the strategic lead at the Karnataka Health Promotion Trust, Bangalore. Her work lies at the intersections of childhood studies and sociology of education. She's also led several projects on early childhood skilling, indigenous childhoods, and has also worked as a child psychologist. Hi, Maitreyi. Welcome to CCYSC Awaaz.
Hi, Vidya. It's nice speaking to you again. Just want to start off by thanking Pooja, Singh, Sanjana, who are all organizing this, and Dini also for putting this forum together.
Thanks, Maitreyi. So I'll get started. My first question is actually more about how you've traversed across psychology, sociology, and the diverse field of childhood studies in both your education and your work. How do you see these different disciplinary terrains shaping the idea of the child in India? Do you see disciplinary frameworks or certain disciplinary frameworks still dominating and shaping certain perspectives? And how do you think that these discourses can be revisited and renewed in both academic and practitioner spaces?
Thanks, Vidya. That's a great question. I started working across psychology, sociology only as late as my PhD. But I think we continue in India to actually work much more in disciplinary silos. And you're right that there are certain disciplines which dominate the field when it comes to the child, particularly psychology, which influences education and policy around the child as well. The child, according to me, still remains marginal to disciplines like sociology or history or political science. And I think this sort of limits the way we understand childhoods or youthhoods. So what I see, like your question about how we can sort of revisit and renew academic discourses and academic practices around the child. I do think we need many more sort of interdisciplinary departments. So I really benefited from being at a space like NIAS, which had like cross-disciplinary influences, both from the social and the natural sciences. Though I'm well aware of the problems of introducing sort of cross-disciplinary forum like that at the graduate level or even at the master's level. Even if we can't have more institutions or departments which are interdisciplinary in that fashion, I definitely think we need to create more forum where this kind of interdisciplinary conversation can happen. I think the CCYSC forum is one good place. So I'm really glad that an intervention like this has been started by Divya and Anandini. And I also take hope from some of the recent events that have happened across the spaces of education and childhood studies in India, like the Shivnada Conference on Childhood and Youth that Divya and Anandini put together at the beginning of this year. Also the Ahmedabad Education Workshop that you yourself were involved in, Vidya, along with Leah, Marianne, Karishma, myself, which allowed us to bring people from very different disciplines together. And I think that was a rich forum. And I think most students could sort of benefit if we created more occasions like these.
Thanks so much, Maitreyi. I'm now moving towards speaking a little bit or asking you a little bit more about your PhD work. Your PhD work examined the life skills education program for adolescents within a Foucauldian lens, and it also raised a lot of complex observations around the largely universalistic framework of how these programs are generally posited towards, say, children of the poor. I also understand that this program is led by NGOs and is recently also being driven in government schools through a PPP mode. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your journey of choosing this theme for your PhD research and maybe your experiences of navigating the research field, things like getting access, permissions, building trust. I think those aspects would be really interesting.
Thanks, Vidya. That's another great question. So I think my interest in life skills education actually started off as a reflection of my own positionality as an upper caste, middle class researcher who growing up had a lot of access to self-help literature, and was exposed to what Lauru famously calls concerted cultivation within middle class homes, right? And along with this, having done a master's in psychology, I think a lot of my initial thinking around life skills education and around children in general had been shaped by these two experiences. Because I was very fascinated when I came across life skills education in psychology, because it seemed to offer a very non-medicalizing, non-stigmatizing approach to behavioral problems in children, unlike most of the other therapeutic approaches that I had been exposed to. And this is what I also meant by working in disciplinary silos earlier, because before I sort of started my PhD, I was mostly exposed only to psychology and the way psychology frames individuals as problems located within the individual emerging from a biology more than a sociology. And so I think that's how I started off the Life Skills Project, because in a very sort of benevolent, naive, do-good fashion, I wanted to kind of bring a non-stigmatizing approach to children's behavioral issues, emotional issues, psychological issues into the mainstream. So that was largely my concern. But I was quite surprised when I started off with my work, which was in government schools in Bangalore, because I assumed that there would already be a life skills program running in these schools, because by then life skills education had actually caught much currency, because the WHO was really advocating these programs. It had become a part of NCF 2000-2005. The NCERT was supposed to have come out with a life skills education module and so on. So I thought like I would actually be able to look at the impacts of these programs on children in government schools. And to my biggest surprise, none of the respondents at the government schools that I visited were able to tell me much about these programs at all. And what that got me to realize was that the whole discourse of life skills education was actually sort of moving in exclusive middle class circuits. So where I did get to see these programs, they were largely being conducted by other middle class actors like myself with similar kinds of naive, benevolent, sort of do-good intentions to build children's resiliences to the kinds of risk environments, as they would call it, that they were exposed to. And these risk environments were usually contexts of poverty, contexts of broken families, alcoholism within the family, as though all of this only existed among disadvantaged children and disadvantaged communities, very rightly, like you pointed out, among the poor. And that's how I sort of had to change my trajectory and start rethinking about these programs itself. And in the process, I stopped sort of focusing on the impact of these programs on children and started much more focusing on how these discourses and practices were being shaped by a set of middle-class actors, NGOs, by all kinds of CSR funds, aid that was coming in for life skills education and so on.
Thanks, Maitri. This term life skills education that you use, it's such a generic term. It seems to encompass anything and everything. Could you throw some light on the varied ways in which, say, life skills is conceived for adolescents through your PhD work? And also, how does the program construct the category of adolescent?
Very true, Vidya. I actually like to think of life skills as what Bonnie Uccioli calls a strategically deployed shifter, which is basically a term that doesn't have a meaning of its own, but takes meaning based on the context in which it is applied to. So when I started off, I actually had a very definitive understanding of life skills, like I said, from my psychology background. But throughout my fieldwork, what I got to see was life skills could mean anything from gardening to physical education, to computer literacy, to financial management, computer skills, English speaking, literacy, numeracy, and so on. Basically, any skill that was thought to be sort of relevant or useful for the poor child. But in psychology, actually, life skills has a very specific meaning. And it's usually used, especially if you look at WHO literature, which drives much of the work on life skills education that is being done, whether it is at national level or through NGOs or CBOs, there's a very definitive meaning and understanding of life skills education as a set of cognitive, intrapersonal, and interpersonal skills like self-awareness, critical thinking, decision-making, and so on. Mainly, like you can see, these are psychological skills, as though all of life itself is only about the psychology of it. But rather than saying how these programs were looking at the category of adolescents, I think what I'd like to sort of flag off is how the discourse of life skills itself has been so powerful in shaping categories. So currently, if you just even look at, do a web search of life skills, you will actually find that there are life skills programs for anything from from things like self-esteem or confidence or gender empowerment to even things like how to be a good parent or how to be like a good boss in a corporate structure and so on. So I think more than just thinking of how adolescents got framed within the life skills discourse, I think I'd like to point out that the discourse is powerful enough to shape certain ideas around risk, resilience, success, what it means to be educated, what it means to be empowered, and so on. So it frames very many more categories than just categories like adolescence or childhood.
You've used a Foucauldian lens for your work. I was wondering if you could discuss a little about Foucault's discourses of governmentality and the ways in which it helped to understand what you were seeing in the field. Also, often as scholars, we are rarely asked about the limitations of these lenses that we use as well. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your own challenges of using Foucault.
Yeah, so basically I kind of stumbled upon Foucault very inadvertently as I was trying to resolve my own sort of difficulties traversing psychology and sociology. Also simultaneously on the field, I was intensely undergoing practices of self-work, self-introspection as a participant observer in many of these programs, which is leading to a lot of questions about myself, like who I was and what position I was occupying on the field. But at the same time, I was also observing other participants, like the facilitators of these programs, who came from very different social backgrounds compared to me. So they belong much more to lower middle class or rural backgrounds. And I saw them struggling with these programs, and the ways in which they were making meaning of these programs were very different from how I was making meaning of these programs. So all of this kind of got me thinking about the various discrepancies in meaning, not only between how sociology and psychology explained the same problem, but also how meaning was being guided and shaped through these programs about our own selves. I think I was kind of led to think about life skills education at a meta level, I started wondering about the kinds of meaning, the ways in which it helped shape my own understanding of myself. So that's basically how I got into this Foucauldian framework, because I was trying to understand how these knowledge discourses, not just of psychology or sociology or the program literature, but also the ways in which the NGOs were presenting these programs or were presenting the skills, etc., were all powerfully creating a set of meaning for each of us to take and measure ourselves against. And at the same time, actually, one of my doctoral committee members, Dr. Shekhar Sheshadri, had suggested to me to read Umberto Eco's Foucault's Pendulum, which of course is not really what Foucault talks about, this whole nexus of power and knowledge, lead me indirectly to Foucault and his works, particularly to archaeology and order of things, which I think then answered a lot of questions that I was struggling with at that time. So, to answer your question on limitations, Vidya, I don't know if I would call this a limitation of Foucault's work itself, but I think the basic premise of Foucault's work is about how power operates in modern societies. And his argument is, of course, that through the ways in which knowledge is produced and deployed, we are made objects and subjects of various forms of power. And I think what basically he's trying to argue is that there is no central authority, but power is sort of controls by the ways in which it helps us make meaning of ourselves, make meaning of the world around us, and how we participate in upholding these meanings itself. Though he does not, of course, discount the possibilities for resistance or appropriation or negotiation and so on, which is a point I think a lot of people miss about his work. But in terms of how this framework can be limiting, I think I have been critiqued very often for the way in which I read all my data discursively, drawing on his ideas, when actually material contexts and resources create very many sort of painful inequalities in the real world. So to argue that, say, caste-based or religious violence or material deprivation, which can lead to death, is because of a set of discourses through which power is controlled, just does not seem to be adequate enough. I mean, because it's also, it also then does not allow you to do much about this, right? Like, how do you counter a set of meanings? How do you then challenge this kind of power? But and so I always wonder if I've kind of taken to the Foucauldian framework because it's much easier to intellectualize some of these problems than actually engage with material struggles. So this is, I would say, like a critique of myself more than Foucault's work itself. And another big challenge that I've often encountered subscribing so much to Foucault's ideas is that it can be very paralyzing in the moment of action. Because when you know that what you are doing is also producing a set of discourses, and the very interventions that you may be engaged in will also produce governmental effects, then how do you act, especially when it comes to contexts of intention like I'm engaged in right now at KHPT, where we also run life skills education programs that I have been so much critic of at the conceptual level. Although, I mean, that is not to say there aren't any life skills education programs that aren't sort of enabling for the recipients that receive these programs. KHPT's programs themselves are actually a good example of this, along with, say, the Mahila Samakya program, which was functional earlier and so on. But I think the unresolved question for me still remains about who is shaping these programs and how are these norms produced at the sites of intervention, whose values, cultures, and practices do we represent in these sites of intervention. And, you know, so in a context, say for example, you're working in a context which has wide gender inequalities, like our case in Koppal, where we are running these life skills education programs. Of course, I do think it is important to change these gender norms and address the kinds of inequalities that it produces. But I also often wonder, what does an intervention like this do to the community, and how does it change power structures, and how do we know whether these can create other forms of inequalities or distributions of power or not? So I think that's a point that I struggle with, particularly because of the kind of framework that I subscribe to.
Thanks, Maitri. One of your recent research projects is on the very understudied area of early childhood, where you and your team have conducted intensive ethnographic research in the state of Bihar to understand how families are choosing low-cost private schools for their children to navigate a very highly stratified and competitive schooling system where even the role of the state has not been very strong. I was wondering if you could discuss some insights on how this played out in the state of Bihar, which is also for very long occupied a very low position in terms of education development in our country.
Sure, Vidya. But I'd like to kind of speak about the Bihar context in relation to Tamil Nadu, which was the other state in which we conducted this particular study that you're talking about. This study was undertaken when I was at CBP, along with the University of Cambridge, especially in collaboration with Dr. Aarti Sri Prakash. I think the reason why I want to kind of position both together is because I think these two states produced for us very different insights, especially because we started off wanting to examine the cause, context, and practices around childhood and how these practices are shaped by the political economy and the context itself. But before I go to that, let me just start off to say that, of course, we've had a long history of ECC in India. So we have one of the largest ECC programs in the form of the ICDS, which goes back almost to the 1970s. Though ECC is still not regulated as a right currently, hopefully it will with the new NEP. Though we've had a long history of ECC, what has happened is that the priorities in the ICDS program has been very different. So education has received much less of an attention, and most of the attention has gone to survival and nutrition and health of the child, because that's how the program started, at a point when India was really struggling with very poor child mortality indicators. But having said that, we should also note that the ICDS curriculum is one of the most developmentally appropriate curriculum for ECC available when you compare it to what private preschools, especially the low-cost private preschools like we saw in Bihar, are offering. In the case of Bihar, what essentially was happening was that there was an abject state failure and corruption. So because of this kind of entrenched corruption and casteism that was prevalent, there was also a deep distrust within the community of any kind of welfare provision by the state itself. And again, like I said, because the ICDS program for the longest time has been focused on nutrition and immunization, parents also didn't consider this a site for education itself. With the ICDS curriculum also being focused on more developmentally appropriate practices like play, compared to the kind of rote learning practices, the intensive sort of reading, writing, numeracy, literacy practices in private preschools, parents actually thought when their children went to these Anganwadis, they were doing nothing at all. There was no learning going on in the Anganwadis at all. So that, therefore, that clamor for private preschooling, which was understood not only to offer their children this kind of academic knowledge, that is like knowledge of numbers or alphabets and things like that, but also there was this understanding that it would offer their children the right kind of cultural capital of dress, discipline, mannerisms, language that children from elite families had access to. And therefore, they thought putting their children in these private preschools would also offer their children a head start when it comes to primary schooling. So actually, what we saw in the context of Bihar was just like we've seen it with elementary education. By not regulating the private sector and enforcing and not enforcing norms for curricular and pedagogic practices in the early years, the state was actually very much complicit in the educational stratification in the preschool years. And additionally, it was also condoning these inappropriate practices of rote learning, memorization, excessive focus on academic work. That's actually very damaging for young children, which we saw in the private preschools, often of very poor quality, and which were also engaged in corporal punishment practices of very young children. Basically, I think in the Bihar case, it was a combination of lack of regulation, but also the complete failure of the state to kind of cater to parental aspirations for their children and sort of address this kind of wide caste inequalities that were very visible in education right from the preschool years. But when I'm making this point, I also want to be cautious and say that while regulation and norms and things like that is very important for ECC, at the same time, when we kind of looked at the Gudulur context, the Tamil Nadu context, we were also very acutely sort of made aware of the problems of universal norms or universal regulation of ECC settings. Because what we saw in the Tamil Nadu context was completely different. Like, I mean, we all know that Tamil Nadu is a much better functioning state, and this is true also of the ECC years. They have much better indicators for child development. ICDS is performing much better in Tamil Nadu. And along with this, of course, because they've had a very long history of the self-respect movement, the kinds of blatant casteism that we observed in Bihar was very much absent in the Anganwadis that we were visiting in Tamil Nadu. And the program was much more active compared to the Bihar program. So there were preschool education classes being conducted, food was being given regularly, immunization was regular, and so on. But despite this relatively well-functioning system of the Anganwadi and the ICDF, and even the availability of a contextualized curriculum. So the Tamil Nadu ICDS actually has a curriculum called Aadu Paadu Vilayadu Paapa, which is in Tamil, it means sing, dance and play child. So basically they had contextualized it to the state's context. And despite this kind of contextualization of the program, and very few private preschools, unlike what we saw in the Bihar case, in the tribal areas of Gudlur, where we were located for our study, we found that the uptake of these programs and provisions was actually very poor. In this process, like through our observation, I think what we understood is even despite the contextualization of the curriculum, it wasn't really contextualized enough for the Adivasi child, which was like the major populations in the sites that we were located in. By this, I don't just mean the issues of contextualization based on language or the representation of tribal knowledge, which is discussed a lot in educational literature in relation to curriculum and textbooks and so on. But I think what our field informants were actually pointing to us was something much more significant and much more deeper, which is this point about what purpose would this kind of formal schooling serve their children. So what they kind of foregrounded to us was this precarious relationship between education and their futures. And at the same time, they kind of gave us insights into the historically stronger relationships they have had with the forest and its economy, and how life itself was organized around this economy. Now, with formal education, the chances of progress in the future for their children was very limited, because at best, completion of 10th standard or SSLC was offering them small forest jobs like that of an anti-poaching watcher or a mahout or something like this, whereas the prospects beyond it were actually much bleaker for them. But in terms of the forest, learning about the forest, learning about its economy, learning about survival in the forest took precedence, because this is what kind of supported the meager resources that they were able to gather through the formal economy, the modern economy. And therefore, for them, centering the forest within education, not just in terms of learning its patterns, its seasons, the kinds of resources that they can fend off from the forest, not just these patterns, but also centering the forest in terms of their rights around the forest to land. These kinds of issues were very important to them. And they would constantly tell us if education was taking their children out of the community, they'd rather not educate their children further. They'd rather have their children come back to the community. So educated members of the Adivasi community were valued for how they could bring this modern education back to the forest and help the community sort of bargain for their rights, understand their rights better, to deal with issues of the community with this education. So if it was going to take them out, then it didn't serve their purpose. I think what they were actually signaling to us was something very, very deep. This relationship between modern education and the modern subject, who is individualized in that whole process of schooling and formal education that he or she goes through. And what they were comparing it against was this kind of communal structure that their children belong to, and that was important for their survival and survival of generations in the future. So I think it kind of gave us a very, it was very thought-provoking in many ways, especially to think around these universalization of norms, universalization of curriculum, having sort of the same kinds of practices, which we call developmentally appropriate for all children. So it gave us a lot to think about these two states in sort of a comparative manner.
Finally, Maitri, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about your present work at KHPT Bangalore.
So KHPT is an organization that works in the area of health, Vidya, and it's been working with some of the most vulnerable groups like people living with HIV/AIDS, female sex workers, transgenders, and so on. And I am particularly involved in their interventions with adolescents, which also started off from the HIV context and interventions with female sex workers in North Karnataka, where child marriages have been traditionally high. Also because there is a prevalence of this system called the Devdasi system, where girls are ritually dedicated to sex work. And it's also prevalent today. So that's the context in which they started their work with adolescents, because they realized that this transition into sex work starts during the adolescent period. And keeping adolescents in school was one of the ways in which you can sort of reduce their exposure to these issues. So in terms of what we do with these adolescent girls, we basically have, like I said, a life skills education program called Spoorthi, which we use in order to reduce dropout of girls from school, improve their nutrition levels, address menstrual health issues among them. So this Spoorthi model is basically a peer-to-peer transformative learning model. But what is really interesting to me, and what was really exciting to me about this work, was the kind of approach that KHPT was using. Basically, the program creates a set of role model girls in each village who then start working with other peer girls in the village through life skills education sessions, through group meetings, through things like communication and leadership training, exposure visits, and so on. And through the course of these interactions, what basically happens is that there is a collectivization of the girls, which also builds their confidence levels and their agencies, because in numbers, they're able to negotiate much better. And along with this, what KHPT also tries to do is to work with the community, and especially the parents of the girls. Unlike most life skills education programs, which target only the individual, the understanding here is that unless you change social contexts and structures, developing girls' own abilities or skills or agencies will not have much effect. So what they do is they have this forum called Samvadas, with parents, with community leaders, with panchayat members, etc., where girls are able to come together and discuss their issues, their challenges, negotiate for things like going to school, or about issues of eve teasing, or even negotiate for provisions that they want within the community, whether it's water or whether it's better sanitation facilities, or like in some cases, for example, they have negotiated for building of a boundary wall for their schools. So they are able to take their issues to the community and also to their own parents to negotiate about things like marriage, age at marriage, choice of partner, continuation in school. And girls also support each other in these negotiations. So girls visit other families where girls have been pulled out of school, or who are at the danger of child marriage and so on. And they help each other sort of bargain for their rights. That is what has been most interesting to me about this life skills education model.
Thanks, Maitri. You've moved from the space of research on children and youth to a space of intervention. How different is it to research, say, children or youth and intervene with them? Have there been new learnings from this experience for you?
Well, with the thing with intervention is that there is an immediate feedback you have access to when you try out an idea or a conceptual framework, or you're using some theory to inform your intervention, and you're able to see whether you succeed or fail with this. With research, I think there's somewhat of a distance between you and your ideas and the implications it has in the real world. And I mean, this is not to say that, of course, research has a lot of responsibility, a lot of ethical responsibility that it demands. But I think in the context of intervention, it becomes so much more evident, because you are right there in the field as an expert, and it really sort of makes you think about the kind of power that you're wielding in this moment, based on your knowledge, based on your experience, based on the kinds of interventions that you're proposing or you're sort of undertaking. And I think if research demands reflexivity, I think intervention demands double that reflexivity. Because unless you sort of plan for moments to reflect on what you're doing, to have a discussion, to ensure representation of voice, to sort of question your own position on the field, I think you can easily get washed away with that flow of the moment. And you might not be conscious of the kinds of impacts. You may not be conscious of the kinds of impacts that you're creating on field, which have a lot of implications in terms of power, in terms of inequalities, in terms of representation, and so on. So I think in that sense, intervention is very immediate. The other challenge with intervention is also scale. Often in a lot of research work we do, I think we tend not to ask this question about scale, especially when we're looking at scale and quality. And I can say this for myself from my own experience with these life skills education programs, because often when I would go back to my organizations and provide a critique of what they were doing, I would often ask questions about the quality of their interventions, the procedure of their facilitation, and so on. And they would always kind of throw back a question of scale to me. They would always ask me, how do you ensure a certain quality, or how do you ensure a certain process, or how do you ensure the transfer of learnings across scale? And I'm not sure I have an answer to it now that I am in intervention, but this is a question that definitely does sort of bother me much more. Also because I constantly worry that in this process of scaling things, I might inadvertently compromise on certain aspects of the intervention.
How has the COVID situation presently influenced the nature of interventions in this sphere, Maitri? And what sort of concerns do you see emerging in this space of work for you?
So there's a lot actually been written about this COVID context and issues on the field, especially with adolescents, with girls, and other kinds of vulnerable populations, rural populations, and so on. So I don't want to repeat it. In the context of the girls we are working with, we are seeing really what a lot of other report is talking about in terms of increase in economic pressures, which are leading to more dropout from school, or increased child marriages, increase in gender-based violence, and so on. But what we're also seeing, at least among the girls that KHPT has been working with in some of these villages in North Karnataka, are new forms of leadership, which is actually very, very inspiring. So some of the participation that we're observing by the girls is way beyond the scope of the program itself. We did not really conceive of these kinds of activities for the girls to take up leadership around. So for example, during the lockdown, one of the things that got affected was the supply of sanitary pads for girls, because this used to get supplied through the school. And once schools shut down, supply of sanitary pads were also affected. And it was actually classified as a non-essential item in the government's list. So one of the amazing stories for us from the field was about how a young girl called Suma, who was part of the Spurti program, actually wrote to a local activist and a district collector, and the district collector, restart the supply of sanitary pads to her village. And there was immediate action actually taken by the district administration, and she was also facilitated by the Minister for Women and Child Development in Karnataka. And the supply of sanitary pads were restored, actually preventing serious menstrual health issues for thousands of girls, not just for her. In another case, we heard of girls sort of engaging in making homemade masks and distributing them, because in the rural context, even the 10-15 rupee masks that we can easily procure in the city are quite expensive. So they started making these masks at home and started distributing them. But I think among all these case studies, what has been the most amazing to me has been a set of girls, again, who were part of our program earlier, who sort of started paying attention to this increasing context of unemployment in their villages. And so then decided they had to do something about it. And in fact, they were not just happy with distribution of ration, etc., in this context, because they realized that these were one-time solutions. So they on their own, sort of through their own efforts of thinking and leadership and planning, they realized that what would be more sustainable is to link the community back to government schemes like the Udyog Khatri Yojana or the MNREGA scheme and so on. And what is really amazing is the ways in which this has upturned gender stereotypes and gender relations in the rural context of Koppal, because these are young girls who have been negotiating with middlemen called Metis, who are basically the ones who control the labor gangs for MNREGA, who have been taking bribes and not been kind of giving employment to many of the villagers. They have negotiated with the panchayat to restore funds for bund building activities in their villages. And in this way, they have actually provided employment to hundreds of people in their village. And what is most exciting about this whole episode to me is the fact that normally when you associate girls with the domestic sphere and you think of them as not capable of taking certain actions in the public sphere, especially things like dealing with administration, dealing with finance, dealing with middlemen. These are the kinds of things that the girls have started showing leadership in, which is really amazing to me. And I think it's really heartening for the program itself, because I don't want to take credit for these transformations at all, because I joined KHPT just 6 months back. But I think what the program has intended to do and what it has managed to do is actually sort of create a powerful medium of critical education for these girls. And really, this is what, coming back to my life skills work, I think this is really what life skills education should be about. Because if life skills education is about skills like being self-aware or having better interpersonal relations or being able to take critical decisions, to think critically about problems, arrive at solutions. I think these are the kinds of things that we really need for social transformation. And therefore, I think in a way, seeing these girls has also reiterated my original interest in working around life skills education. So personally, I think this situation has been very, very inspiring and really motivating for me.
Thank you so much, Maitreyi, for this really interesting conversation that has spanned your PhD research work, your policy research work, and now finally the space of intervention at KHPT. I'd like to thank Divya and Anandini especially for giving me this opportunity to interview you, and of course, our student volunteers, Sanjana, Pooja and Singh. Thank you so much, Maitreyi, again.
Thank you, Vidya. It was a great pleasure talking to you.